Okay, so to start the story just a little bit over, I was in this diner having breakfast. This man and his young little 5-year-old son were getting ready to leave. And there's this big jar of like gummy worms and gummy bears, all kinds of gummy animals in it, right at the kid's eye level, right? Exactly where his eyes were hitting. And he started plucking his father's sleeve and being like, I want one. And it's kind of like being a little bit energetic about it, maybe a touch of a pest. And it was really sweet. The father turned to him and instead of saying, no, it's breakfast time, you can't have candy yet or anything like that, he just like very kindly said, yeah, you really want those, huh? And the kid nods vigorously and then stops talking about it. And off they walked. And I was just a little bit in awe of the parental jujitsu, first of all, but also of the extraordinary, just absolute respect the father had for his young son and the complete attention with which he turned to this kid and gave him exactly what he needed in terms of acknowledgement without buying into the request or the story, right? No buy-in. So I think for me, this kind of exemplifies a wise and compassionate or loving response, right, to our own minds or to situations. This ability to turn towards any kind of unpleasant, afflictive thought, request, pattern, inner temper tantrum with that kind of, oh, this is how it is. I get that. I see you. I acknowledge it. And I don't know about you, but my mind still has plenty of impulses that aren't necessarily in my own best interest, right? And whether you call them greed, hatred, or delusion, or whether you call them the five hindrances of sensual desire, ill will, restless and remorse, sloth and torpor, doubt, whatever it is, they come for most human beings, they kind of come installed and that conditioning rolls around. But there's this way of being able to turn towards, relate to them, that has them stop pestering us, right? So I think of it kind of as like loving my impulses, but not indulging them, like not necessarily believing them. I remember my niece was probably around that same age, about 6, and we were at some potluck or something, big, big gathering. And she had the entire table transfixed with this story of a cat driving a convertible across the Golden Gate Bridge. Right? Everybody was just, and she was telling it with real flair, like this little kid. And everyone gave her that same kind of loving attention. Did anyone believe the cat drove the convertible? I think so. But the loving the process, the loving the being without buying into the lie, delusion. So acknowledging, respecting, empathizing with the need, but there's this how of the not indulging, right? And the seeing, as you all know, is the first step. Mindfulness, mindful awareness, loving awareness, whatever you want to call it. And then seeing it, a thought as a thought, an impulse as an impulse, greed as greed, whatever, however you want to categorize. And then there is the re-negotiating of the relationship with that, whatever that is. Cat in a convertible, wanted gummy bear, pestering thought, whatever. And what comes to mind to me about this is many of you probably know the very famous marshmallow experiment, marshmallow study. It's been around for decades, right? And this whole idea that they put these young kids into an experimental room and they were promised, they were allowed to have one marshmallow if they ate it after the experimenter left the room, but if they could wait till the experimenter got back, they could have two marshmallows. Very big deal for certain age groups, right? And the way the study is often described is it was a predictor of self-control, impulse control, that predicted all of this success or lack of success, and all these kind of different metrics of life for decades. But recently I heard, within the last 5 or 6 years, I heard the author of the study, a famous man named Walter Mischel, might be mispronouncing his name, but that scientist wrote a follow-up book decades after this study, in part because he didn't like the way popular culture talked about the results of this study. He thought that the popular results missed the point. Yes, the self-control, the impulse control was important, but the point of the experiment is that it can be learned by anyone, not just kids, adults too. And that renegotiation of the relationship with our own impulses, it can be a set point that's never changed. However, it's highly changeable and adaptable well into adulthood. That's good news, right? So what this renegotiation is often learning a way to be with, either just observing, or the being able to turn towards with this kind of loving concern or loving interest. There's an ouch. Being like a loving parent or a loving guardian that is checking out the boo-boo on the kid's elbow or knee, right? There's investigation happening there. But there's tenderness, kindness too, with that turning towards. Another way of being with that is really helpful. And I see this in my work in the hospital as a chaplain, is this sounds kind of counterintuitive, but it's universalizing the suffering. I'm with a lot of people who are going through really, really hard stuff, like just first arrow in the Buddhist sense kind of stuff. Sickness, death, family separation, whatever. And feeling connected with others is a huge part of the healing or the solace that's offered to these people, whether it's with a chaplain or family members or friends or a loving nurse or whoever, right? There's this, that is a huge piece. And then another huge piece is there's a certain kind of strength, equanimity, and sense of connectedness among people who are in that kind of suffering if they recognize that everyone goes through some version of it, that it's not unique. I mean, each case is unique to each person in a sense, and all of us grow sick. If we're lucky, we get old, and all of us die, right? And the folks who have a sense of that have so much more equanimity about what they're moving through. There's like this kind of matter-of-factness strength there. And then that can flip to a sense of extraordinary compassion, right? Because everyone wants to live, well, most of the time anyway. But people want to live and not die, be happy and not sad. And that kind of wish kind of weaves through all human hearts at some level, no matter how blocked away or how morphed or twisted it might become for some people. There's almost a mammalian wish to be alive and be in connection that runs through all of us. And that too kind of gives rise to this extraordinary compassion and sense of interconnectedness, right? Which is a real resource for a lot of people in difficulty. It's like being able to step back and see the big picture. It's okay, just like me, others want this, just like me. That kind of empathy. So those were a couple of ideas. And then this starts to translate somewhat into a kind of, trying to think of the right word here. Formula sounds too formulaic, but I'll just use formula, like this simple way of considering conditionality of cause and effect, right? And one simple way that's very powerful and most of you are familiar with is the Four Noble Truths. This is suffering. There is suffering. There's the arising of suffering, the ending in the path. Another way is to notice before, during, and after thought, word, or action, whether there's harm or affliction or whether there's benefit. And this is a teaching the Buddha gave. I'm sure I've talked about it here before. It's to his, at the time, 7-year-old son, Rahula. And it is basically him asking his son, what's the purpose of a mirror, son? Son, to reflect, dad. He says, noble sir, I think in the suttas, but I imagine dad. And the Buddha says, yeah, exactly. So before you engage in an intentional plan, an intentional thought, we can't be totally responsible for the ones that just flip through, intentional speech or intentional action, reflect, will this cause harm or will this cause benefit? And then while you're doing it, reflect, will this cause harm or will this cause benefit? And then after, did this cause harm for myself, for the other person, for both, or did it cause benefit for self, other, both? And this kind of process, considering consequences, knowing internal consequence and effect, it both relies on a sense of compassion and wisdom. It also builds a sense of compassion and wisdom over time, right? Because if we're noticing how things play out, most of us are going to learn from that and loop back and shift what we do. Oh, that didn't work so well in that conversation. Maybe I'll try something different next time, right? We learn the whole system. So they kind of merge in a way, that's not wanting to cause harm and having that metric. That process loops back and builds the wisdom. So those are a few notions. I guess I'll also say that that process kind of applies at every level. It can apply to the self-talk about my own impulses. It can apply in relationship, one-on-one. It can apply in groups, cultures, workplaces, right? It gets more complex then because we are not the sole cause of anything. Yet we can notice where there might be a beneficial impact. So cultivating, to drill that piece down, cultivating the wholesome and letting go, refraining from the unwholesome, kusla and akusla in Pali. That's the real key. It's that simple. And then the Buddha added this nuance of notice before, notice during, and notice after. And most of us, I know for me, I typically learn, I know this was true of mindfulness, maybe it was true for some of you, it starts out in the afterwards, right? Oh yeah, that happened. And then slowly, we have enough of those come up. And then at some point, it sort of migrates back to during. Oh, this is happening. Yeah. And then slowly, earlier and earlier and earlier in the trajectory of whatever is going on, until one blessed day, one notices the instant before opening one's mouth or doing whatever it is. Oh, there it is. And then finally, and this is a level of, I guess you could say, freedom. With enough of that training, the impulse itself goes away. It just doesn't come up, or at least it doesn't come up very often. And it's fascinating to me, this trajectory, because it does, it kind of works its way backwards with, I would say most of us learn that way, with this real-time observation, with this cultivation of different ways of being, right? So, another piece that I've really found helpful is asking for the sake of what am I practicing? Why? How come? And it is a completely valid answer to say, because I want to suffer less, or it makes me happier, or it can be something much bigger. I want to make the world a better place by the way I am, or what, or I want to be completely free. Completely free. All of those are valid. But remembering the why, for the sake of what, can be such a huge boon, motivator to keeping with practice itself and to noticing, correcting, course correcting with wisdom and compassion in our lives, right? There's a transformative process of noticing, being able to be with all of the dark corners of the heart and mind when there is a larger vision or goal or why for the practice. As many teachers have said, I think I remember Joseph Goldstein first saying this, like, mindfulness, self-awareness is usually not good news at first, right? The blind spots are usually blind for a reason. We don't want to see them because they're unpleasant. They're not egocentric. They don't fit who we want to be. And if the overall wish is to be free of, let's just say, greed and hatred and delusion or whatever your flavor is, affliction, boy, it's helpful to see it. So if I'm seeing it, it's not got me through the nose. It's not leading me around. It's not running the show. So that compass point, that North Star, whatever yours is such a resource in being able then to take in the totality, whatever your totality is. And at that point, there's this transformative process that can happen where afflictions and obstacles start to become fuel for wisdom, food for compassion. Because if I see all the dark corners, or at least some of them in my own heart and mind, that gives me, I'm kind of hip to the program a little bit. And it's also this way of getting how other people might fall down or show up in ways that are irritating or much worse than irritating, because they've got their foibles and their unprocessed stuff and their dark corners too. Right? So there's a certain kind of compassionate understanding that can develop just through this process. This is a poem by an ancient, highly realized Chinese nun. It's just a bit of the poem. Her name is Ben Ming, or Mingqi. And she was alive she died in 1135, I'll put it that way. She was alive a very long time ago, almost a millennia ago. And she writes, "Don't you know that afflictions are nothing more than wisdom? But to cling to your afflictions is nothing more than foolishness. As they arise and melt away again, you must remember them. Don't you know that afflictions are nothing more than wisdom? And that the purest of lotus blossoms emerges from the mire? If someone were to come and ask me what I do, after eating my gruel and rice, I wash my bowl. Don't worry about a thing. Don't worry about a thing. Part of what I love about that is she's speaking to the fact that these poisons, they called them in this strata of Buddhism, become sources of wisdom. And then the simple ordinariness of seeing that and going about your day, washing your bowl or your plate or whatever. But it's in the relationship. It's where we stand in relationship to what's arising that makes the difference as to whether it's wisdom or something that's not very nice at all. She also is asking us to trust the process. Trust the process. The Buddha has this beautiful simile, and he uses it in relation to all kinds of mental cultivation. Right now, I'm remembering it's definitely in relationship to the seven factors of awakening, but it's in relationship to a lot of others as well. And he talks about how the act of cultivating this is overall in the path of practice, Theravada ancient practice. It's like a hen sitting on her eggs. She may or may not have the intention for them to hatch. But if she sits on them, they will hatch. And if she doesn't, they won't. Right? So the analogy with sitting practice is like, spend some time sitting, right? And talks about how the chicks like peck and scratch and like their little beaks and little claws get them out. And he likens that to awakened beings sort of emerging from this process. This long kind of gestational, natural process. So too, we can trust practice changes our hearts and minds. And while these, like the North Star I was talking about, the why is helpful. All of these different possible ways of relating to it are helpful. Trust, just being with it, staying with it, might be the most helpful thing of all. Just might. So, to recap, noticing, acknowledging, respecting the internal impulses. Not necessarily believing them, but holding them. Relating to them with a certain kind of love or compassion, attention is helpful. A way of being with, noticing beneficial and unbeneficial results is helpful. And adjusting based on what we notice, because we are thinking beings, right? And then lastly, trusting the process. Trusting the process. All of these things together help sort of weave wisdom and compassion together. And you probably know wisdom and compassion are often talked about as the wings of freedom. When both wings are there, it's a whole lot easier for your practice to soar. So thanks for your kind attention. That's what I have to say. I'm very interested in anything you have to say. Questions, comments, protests, all of it's welcome. Yes, Deborah, sorry. I was expecting a Zoom hand, so I wasn't looking down.
So just because nobody else raised their hand, I want to say thank you. That was wonderful. I took a lot of notes. And I loved some of your vocabulary just really resonated for me. I can't find them right now, but yeah, it was just great. It was really just helpful down to earth, you know, very practical, while teaching the Dharma, you know, from what the Buddha has said to what the nun wrote. So it was great. Thank you very much. Appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Deborah. Appreciate it. Yes.
I wrote something down that I'm not sure if you intended or not, but it's what came to me too when you said, and I really appreciated the talk too, thank you, is when you were saying you can love the indulgences without believing in them, you can also love the person without believing the lie they tell, is what I wrote down. And I'm not sure if that's exactly what you were saying, but it made me actually think of today's political situation and challenges with sort of this virtual reality of truth, and how important it is and how challenging it is sometimes. Like, I can think conceptually, don't make an enemy of the person. But then there's that piece of translating that into what do I do? How do I do it? And that was a helpful clue for me on how to do it.
I love what you just said. And I hadn't consciously thought through linking it to misinformation, though I think I've even talked about misinformation in this group before. I would love to hear more about how it provided a clue to relating for you.
For me, it's actionable to say, I want to approach this person with love. But if I feel like they're full of vitriol and I can't trust them, which lies make me feel that way, it's almost like that option is off the table unconsciously or somehow. And so remembering that, because I can think about my own mind and the lies that I tell, and if I can apply that to myself, maybe I can apply that to somebody and try to remember. So it's sort of, you know, a lot of people say mindfulness, like the word in Pali, it really means remembering in a lot of ways too. And so it's maybe that.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. And you knitted together nicely a couple of different themes of the talk, right? Which is the loving, the being and not the action, or the language, and also this recognizing my own imperfections, you know, my own greed, hatred, delusion, you know, white lie or worse, and recognizing that that's usually actually coming from trying to feel safe or trying to be happy. And that might just be the case for a lot of the other people we run across, no matter how frustrating those lies can be, right? Yeah, and it's not easy to action. You're right. I agree. It's not easy to act out of that place. I think one of the things that has kind of softened my heart towards it is encountering people in the hospital dying of COVID who believed the lies they were telling, right? They had sucked up misinformation and promulgated it without knowing it was misinformation and suffered horrible consequences for it. And so just the humility of like, okay, this person obviously did not do this intentionally. Like, they really didn't. So it can get a little harder with some of the ones who are doing it on purpose, but it can still, meeting the person and not the behavior could well be one of the only ways that we can change it, that behavior, right? So, other thoughts, protests, questions? That's wisdom. Yes, Deborah again. Hi.
Sorry, I got a phone call from a cousin just a little while ago. I hesitated to pick up the phone because I really do not like this person. I really do not like this woman. But it was her second attempt at connecting with me. And we had a very pleasant conversation, but I could feel the knot in my throat and in my midsection. So I think I'm hitting on what you and Corey were just speaking about. The way I handled that for myself, I think I did a pretty good job this time, is to act as if, which is something I learned long time ago in a 12-step program, to act as if. And I think that is in keeping with what you were saying about notice it, see the results, and then cultivate change. So I don't want to have those feelings toward this woman, or really toward anybody. I'm going to just eliminate all the people I see on the news who were, you know, causing horrible things to happen around the globe. I don't care if I don't like them. but my goal is with my cousin was to be cordial and pleasant and respectful to both of us, to respect my truth and to be respectful for who she is. You know, she grew up in a foreign country during World War II, and, you know, she just has a whole other story. So that's the best I can do at this point in this incarnation, is to try to be kind and friendly and respect myself and the other person. That's all. I don't know if that's in keeping with what you were saying today, but it's the best I can do for now, anyway.
That is already a lot. Can you imagine all of us? What would the world be like if everyone were trying to do that all the time? It would be quite a different place, right? And what you're saying too about the in keeping with the noticing before, during, and after, I think it very much can be in keeping with that. There's this notion in behavior change that we often think our intentions drive our behavior. However, if we start to change what we do, our attitudes often follow, right? So one example I've heard of this is that if people outlay a tremendous amount of effort, let's say for an adopted animal or child, that causes the feelings of love to grow. Right, the act of caring creates care. So that's what comes up for me when you're talking about it, is that perhaps it's why sila is such an important, sila, ethical comportment, ethical behavior, is such an important bedrock of the Buddhist path, right? As we start restraining ourselves from killing, lying, stealing, that automatically starts to shift the entire body mind to this more wholesome orientation. So I think there's something profound there that you're already doing. Any other thoughts? They don't have to be about the talk or the theme. They can just be practice related to. Yes. Hi, Alice.
Hey, I just maybe misheard, but when you were talking about the study of the marshmallows and the reward, and the kids that could have self-restraint had more success in the future, is that true? They were able to have self-control and that helped with success in the future.
That's the most popular way that study is talked about. But the author of the study has stated since then that that's actually a too simplistic of a reductivist kind of attitude. Because what the study was also trying to show was that if the kids learned techniques to give themselves more self-control, that too had a beneficial trajectory. So part of the point of it is that we can always learn at any time to shift our relationship to our impulses, and that shift of relationship predicts future success.
So that makes perfect sense, but it doesn't seem like it's a problem that you would think of it just as if you have that self-control, that you're going to have more success. And I think it's just implied in my mind that that would just happen, that that would just be, if you knew that that about the study, it's sort of it's implied there that it would be good to have self-control.
Absolutely. And a lot of people didn't have the same leap, didn't make the same leap you did. And we're using it as like a predictor, like kids with less impulse control at 5 are going to be worse adults at 40.
Oh, I could see that it could be misused and that some kids were just flawed because they didn't have that self-control.
Right. So that, I think, was why the author went to the trouble of writing the book. there were enough unintended side effects in the culture behind the way people interpreted the study that he was like, no. I want to point to this behavior change piece.
Yeah. You don't want to get rid of your child just because they can't seem to control themselves when they're 5.
Or assume that they're, you know, bound for an unhappy destination.
Right. Oh, I get a bad one. Darn. Okay, thank you.
Mary, hi.
So I just wanted to thank you again for this talk. And I mean, the biggest place I find that I need to practice is so much so. And I've gotten to the point now where I actually call myself a nice name, but it's like, you know, like sweetheart or whatever. Oh, honey. Yeah. Like, you know, honey, this is hard. But I think that it's when I vocalize things and how I'm thinking about things, especially when it concerns myself, it changes the frame a lot. And I have a soon-to-be daughter-in-law, and she talks about that she does therapy. It's just changing the frame of the story that we're telling ourselves. And when you change, for me, it's changing the frame into a view with compassion as to oppose a view of judgment. Oh, shit, you're doing this again. Excuse my French. But you know what I mean? It's like, you know, just having that little bit of compassion. Like, you know, yeah, you want this, you can't have it. You wish things weren't the way they are. This is really hard. It's okay. And just changing that. And I think that compassion is such a good way, at least it works for me, to change the narrative that I'm telling myself about how things are in the moment. And it's really, really helpful. And I wish for everyone the ability to have that little bit of kindness to themselves. You know, and whatever tricks you used to find that is really important. A lot of times I find myself putting my hand on my heart, you know, thinking about the words I use to address myself and noticing it. So if you have any more to say about that, I'd love to hear it too. So thank you.
Thank you, Mary. First of all, I just want to say that was beautifully said. It's so true, right? Like, I was just talking to a friend today, lifelong practitioner. I think this person's been practicing for 45 years. And when they discovered self-compassion, it changed their practice. Their practice suddenly just blossomed and got so much more meaningful and mature, and it basically changed their life. And that's kind of what you're describing as this new, having a new frame on things. It's kind of like a superpower, right? So I don't know if I have much wisdom to add to it other than to say that this is kind of why I wanted to talk about this today, is that I feel like if we look at things from one perspective, they can look like compassion. And all it takes is shifting just a little bit to realize it's also wisdom. Like what you're describing is wisdom. It's being able to change the frame, the relationship with your thoughts, your narrative with yourself. And that choice, that space, is one definition of a certain kind of freedom. Wisdom, right? So they're so entwined in each other. It's really beautiful. trying to think if there's anything I can add that would improve on what you said, and I can't, other than to say that different people have different roads in to that. The positive self-talk is beautiful. I've used that. Hand on heart, formal metta practice can help. For other people, they hate formal metta practice, but mindfulness gets them there. For some people, it's the path of service. Like, nothing else works, but showing up and helping out others transforms them. Having a more compassionate and self-compassionate, loving attitude towards life. So, yeah. Thank you.